Hey everybody, Ethan here. Look, I know it seems like the end times, right? It's apocalyptic right now. There's no doubt about it. I'm not going to sugarcoat it for you. But luckily, we're doing a movie today that is kind of actually about the end times. It's like a modern ice age. Tons and tons of people die from it. And it's not so bad. Jake Gyllenhaal's really like cute and adorable and young in it. And Dennis Quaid gives you this big old smile. And the people in power who were wrong and who you could make a legit argument are mass murderers are really sorry at the end. And they realize that they're wrong. Just like in reality. I'm sure any day now, everyone in politics is going to come out and go, man, we really messed up and we're going to fix it. This was meant to be hopeful. I'm not sure that I accomplished that, but I hope that you enjoy this episode because it was a ton of fun. Okay, see you later. I got to work on my halftime coach thing. Jeez. Bad science. Did the movie get it right? Bad science. Or will we have to fight? Science. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Bad Science. I'm your host, Ethan Edinburgh. This is the show where we break down the science of a film with a comedian and a scientist. And today, we are talking about one of the most highly requested films since the beginning of the podcast, The Day After Tomorrow, the storm-infested movie from 2004 with a bunch of CGI and Dennis Quaid. I have two absolutely wonderful guests. I'm so excited to do this show. I wish it was 3 hours long, but of course, we're going to go the normal time. First of all, a very good friend of mine, a podcast producer for such shows as The Todd Glass Show and many others. I miss him dearly. It's Aristotle Acevedo.
Hello, I am very happy to be here.
I'm very happy to have you, Aristotle. Did I pronounce your last name correctly? I probably should have asked you that before.
Yeah. I mean, I've had the weirdest name in every school I've ever been to, so I've just accepted no matter what, however anyone pronounces it.
Well, how do you pronounce your last name?
It's supposed to be Acevedo, but Acevedo is usually the go-to.
Okay, great. So I wasn't that far off. Not to an insulting degree.
No, not at all.
Okay, great. And I'm so eager to just catch up with you because it's been a while since we've talked, but I'm gonna save all of that for post climate change discussion.
There won't be any time then, though.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Because we'll be dead.
Joining us today and lecturing us about climate science is a climate science lecturer at the Loughborough University, Dr. Tom Matthews.
Thanks very much, Ethan. Pleasure to be on, and good job on pronouncing the university. A boring name I have, but my institute is a bit more challenging. So good job.
I think that's actually awesome. Dr. Tom Matthews sounds like a really strong, like newscaster name. Like it's just automatically trustworthy.
I'd agree with you 100%.
So yeah, you are a climate science lecturer. Does that mean that you, I assume you also teach classes, but are you trying to inform the world that we are doomed?
Yeah, that's probably the most pessimistic summary of my job.
But okay, sorry about that.
Not too far off the reality sometimes. So a lecturer is, it's a post that I suppose in the US you would call assistant professor. So it's a faculty position in a university and it's research and it's also teaching. And unfortunately, when we talk about climate change, there are some, you know, kind of unpleasant realities that we have to address up front. But a lot of what we talk about is often kind of solution oriented too. So we try not to make it too depressing.
Yeah.
And certainly not depressing as what's in the film. So get that out there.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. This film got depressing real quick.
It certainly did.
So yeah, I mean, what did you first think about the movie? I mean, I assumed you know, like a lot of us probably saw it when it came out. It was a highly successful movie at the time. But I'm curious because I read a little bit about just the scientific community at large taking a huge issue with this film. Did you watch it and just say like, oh my God, I wish that they were a little bit more accurate?
Yeah, so the history of this film, the timing's quite interesting. So it came out in 2004, which is the year before I started university as an undergraduate, the year before I started college. And I remember watching it, I think in my first year of study then, and thinking, yeah, perhaps, I mean, my memory's a bit hazy now, but you know, things weren't quite right. And then I watched it again this morning. And yeah, I mean, it's an entertaining film. I really enjoyed watching it. But the science is pretty much as wrong as it could be. The best bit is the beginning. The context is good. So the context is quite interesting, this idea of a tipping point and rapid climate change. And the mechanism is approximately right. It's one that is possible. this shutdown of the thermohaline circulation, but everything else from the kind of the climate that the results and the speed which you get there is wrong. The representation of all the individual weather processes is wrong. So yeah, pretty much kind of all the science is upside down, as it were. So it's fantastic entertaining, but it's certainly not accurate when it comes to the science.
Right. Okay. I thought about the same. Was that the reaction that you had, Aristotle? I mean, I'm sure you weren't looking at it the first time you saw it as like, how scientifically accurate is this film? But I feel the same as far as the entertainment value. I mean, it's a fun viewing.
It is a fun movie. I was surprised when you asked me to do this one, because I thought, wait, how does he know that this was one of my favorite movies?
Oh, I did not know.
At the time.
Wow.
My sister and I would constantly rewatch a bunch of movies, and this was one of them.
What were those other movies? Now, I'm just curious now.
They're not at the same time. I'm just bringing the ones up top. But Hot Rod is another big one.
Oh, yeah.
Jimmy Neutron, okay. When, you know, that came out. But I remembered this movie fondly, and then rewatching it, it was the same kind of reaction of like, wow, this is wild. This is a crazy movie.
Yeah, big time. I mean, it's the same director that did Independence Day, and I was not shocked to learn that at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, one disaster after the next, which does make it really fun. But for today, I feel like we have so much to talk about. There's so many aspects of this film that I think we can break down. But first of all, maybe we can start in like a more umbrella term, you know, category. Like, let's go like super general first, I guess, because, you know, I've had a bunch of different environmental scientists on the show, and eventually we do touch on climate change, global warming, and it's usually terrible news. And so as somebody that does this professionally, like how doomed are we, I guess, is my question. And what hope is there? Like, what can we do that will actually make beneficial change?
That's a really good question.
Thank you so much.
And the first thing to get out there is it's very much in our hands as to how doomed we are. And the second thing to get out there is that, you know, kind of irrespective of the changes that are in the pipeline, that we do have control over. The control is essentially our emissions, our greenhouse gas emissions. We can scale those back and limit the warming. But kind of whatever warming we face, we still can greet that better or worse, depending on how we kind of channel resources into adaptation and dealing with the consequences of a changed climate. So in sort of saying how doomed are we, I'd say it's really in our hands. We of course want to minimize the amount of warming that we cause. And the reason why we want to limit the amount of warming that we cause is that essentially the challenges get bigger and bigger every degree of warming that occurs, every fraction of a degree of warming that occurs. And also when we kind of talk about how much warming is safe, and you may be aware of this 2-degree limit that we're kind of striving to stop warming going past that, and actually an aspirational goal to limit warming to 1.5 degrees. There's kind of the temptation to think, well, if we limit warming to either of those two numbers, then job done, we're safe. And let's just get this out there. It's very difficult, or rather a huge challenge ahead, to limit warming to 1.5 degrees. It requires very rapid reductions to our emissions, equivalent to the reductions that we've seen from the lockdown, the global lockdown from COVID. It essentially requires the same again on top of that each year to about 2030 to get down to the level that we need. And the nasty bit in here is that there might maybe some surprises in the pipeline. And this is a good bridge to the film. So the shutdown of the AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, it's not too well understood how much warming it takes to cut that off. We rely upon computer models to tell us. But they're not great at capturing those processes, or haven't been in the past. There's quite a bit of uncertainty there. So there are some kind of hidden things in there. One is the collapse of the circulation, the security of the ice sheets, them staying there, the Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet. We don't know quite where these critical warming values are that keep those viable. And then there are these things that we kind of know the impact scale per degree of warming, things like the impacts from heat waves worldwide. So essentially, how doomed are we? It's flexible. We certainly want to limit as much warming as far as possible, because we want to avoid unpleasant surprises. And the things that we can see, we certainly want to avoid as much as possible.
Real quick, I also want to ask, because you said it's in our hands. And so that's another reason I thought, like, is that why Ethan asked me? Because I try very hard. I am the annoying friend that's like, is that a plastic water bottle? Is it like I try to run my whole life on a sustainable way as much as I can. But is it really up to those kind of small everyday decisions, or is it because every, you know, big meeting is like, it's the massive corporations that are like just pumping out these gases that we really have to change?
Yeah, I mean, that's again a really good question. And it's an area that, you know, isn't really my area of expertise, but still I follow, and probably we all can follow the advice that's quite easy to tap into out there with respect to what in your daily life can reduce emissions the most. And interestingly, and probably it's not really fair to use this, but it's quite interesting nonetheless, to have one less child is the most carbon efficient thing you can do, the carbon friendly thing you can do at the moment. With every human, you know, has such a big carbon footprint. If you take one out the system, or don't put one in, then you know that's one of the best things you can do. Flying less often, that's in our control. That's again one of the main ones up there. But what's quite interesting, I think, in the context of now, is that, you know, we've had this lockdown, this global lockdown, and granted the estimates of how much it will reduce our emissions over the course of a year factor in the restarting of the economy at some point. But still, that would not take us the required reduction that we need. We would need to keep, you know, upping the ante year after year. So measures in addition to that lockdown. And that lockdown is really a way of seeing perhaps how much, you know, our individual actions, how much difference they can make, because people aren't really traveling much in the midst of that lockdown. You know, the world is looking very different. And we can see how much that you know, moves the needle. We can see it's not enough. So, yeah, undoubtedly, things above the levels of kind of individual actions of citizens are required to deliver the decarbonisation, the very rapid decarbonisation that we need.
Okay, so have less children is basically the thing.
Well, it's not my personal advice. And I say I don't know
how you
said it. Just the medium through which it's delivered.
Don't shoot the messenger.
All that's contingent upon, you know, the carbon footprint of a person staying the same. And of course, we hope it will change. So if it changes and we all become carbon neutral, you can, in theory, have as many kids as you like.
Okay. I had two questions while you were talking about it. One, if there's other, because I know that we're failing as a country. I'm talking about America. That's obvious. But are there other countries that have adopted these measures and that are seeing rapid change? Because I remember, I think we were talking about Fern Gully a month or two back, and there was a rainforest scientist of some sort, I can't remember, that's due to weed, that's a different story. But they were saying how, like, if we leave the rainforests alone, like, because I was basically looking at the information saying, in that regard, we're doomed. And they were saying, like, well, we are doomed at the rate we're going now. But if we do, you know, stop ourselves from going at the same rate, the rainforests have a great ability to recreate, right? They once they're kind of on a roll, then they can really get going. Do you think the climate, like, has a similar ability? Like, if we were to be on lockdown forever, which I really hope is not the case, but, you know, if we were like, oh, these are the rules now, right? Like, we're not emitting anymore, you know, our carbon footprint is way less. Do you think that the climate would kind of get moving at a faster rate?
Yes, I mean, there's a couple of things that are in there. In the context of the global lockdown, you know, a lot's been made of, yeah, the reduction in our emissions, but the way to think about carbon in the atmosphere is that it's a bathtub that's filling up, and the water running into the bathtub is our emissions of CO2. And during the lockdown, we've just turned the tap down. We haven't turned it off. So the bath is still filling up.
Right.
So the you know, carbon dioxide is still accumulating in the atmosphere. So we're still warming the planet as we were sitting there in the midst of the tightest, you know, the tightest time of the lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
Concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere were going up. And so we were still warming the planet. And the other kind of thing, even if we were to stop warming or to stop emitting right now, the planet would still warm up for a period of time. So even if we became carbon neutral now, didn't add any more carbon to the atmosphere. And it takes a while for the climate system to equilibrate.
Momentum situation.
Yeah, the way of thinking about it is momentum. It's basically, it takes time for the oceans to heat up. And until they've finished heating up, the air temperatures won't finish rising. And then the third thing in there is kind of, you know, the way we talk about the climate often is equilibria and, you know, wanting to go back to a natural state. And I think another way of, you know, just an important way of conceptualizing this or appreciating things is the climate, you know, can take care of itself. It's not, you know, it will ultimately settle at a higher average temperature to equilibrate with whatever, you know, concentrations of greenhouse gases are in the atmosphere. And generally, the planet's fine with that. The issue is for us, of course, and it's that we're used to, our systems are used to much lower temperatures, but the climate will equilibrate at some point with whatever level of CO2 is in there, and it will carry on. It's just a shame for us that it will be a bit too warm for us.
Okay. So let's jump to the film, and then we'll come back to scientific aspects of the film. But I wrote down a few things that were, you know, just exceptionally dumb, as I usually do. And so I kind of wanted to bring it up to you guys. I mean, since this is one of your favorite films, Aristotle, I'm sure you can probably even answer some of these.
Used to be.
Yeah, whatever. So the first one was that they broke the vending machines after everyone left the library. Did you guys notice that?
There's
like hundreds of people in there. Wouldn't the first thing be like, hey, we're going to need snacks. Food ASAP.
There's also very little like to let you know how much time has passed. Like they'll kind of reference it, but assuming you're in there a week, then you would have broken those a long time ago. But
that was a huge one that I wrote down. I underlined that. I was like, when did the storm end? How long has it been? Was it 7 to, because he said it would be 7 to 10 days, that this thing would just grow and grow, but it kind of felt like 1 day or 2 days, right?
Yeah, like it happened so quickly, but they're like a good helpful marker of how many days have passed is how when Dennis Quaid is getting to New York, I think they have 2 or 3 nights in the tent.
How did they survive the tent?
Well, there was that Burger King.
Exactly, Wendy's. I think the Wendy's. Actually, and they turned the cooker on, didn't he? And they had a nice little camp out.
All right, I'll buy it. I just felt like if they're freezing in the library, they got to be dead in the tent.
They also they don't show you where Dennis Quaid is at in the journey.
No, that's a mystery.
There's the scene where New York is freezing over, and they say like they're about to be over New York, like the eye of the storm is hitting New York. But you have no reference to where Dennis Quaid is at, except for maybe that mall. But even then,
right? And then like they hit a Staten Island.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought that was a little confusing. And then this one really bothered me: Jake Gyllenhaal's love interest,
Emmy Rossum.
Yes, Emmy Rossum has like a cut, like a deep cut in her leg, and doesn't show anyone. She like passes out from it, and then they figure out what it, like that is. If I have a splinter, I'm showing somebody.
You're screaming off the rooftops.
Somebody help me with this.
I may have missed it, but did they actually give her the penicillin? I know they got it, but I never saw it.
We did not. I don't think we saw that.
Never saw it. No. Okay.
Miracle recovery.
I just couldn't. I was laughing so hard when she's like passed out and everybody's trying to figure out what it is. And somebody, one of the girls that, you know, is like a side character that doesn't even have a name probably, is saying like, well, she was complaining about her leg a few days ago. It's like, what was that like? She was just complaining. She was just saying like, my leg kind of itches. Never mind.
And if she had shown you, wouldn't you like, even though it got infected and got worse, seeing a cut that big, you'd be like, what the fuck? Someone get this person some help.
You are a soldier. Your pain threshold is crazy.
Yeah. Also, this movie, I forgot how silly this movie is. Because the scene where they get the penicillin made me laugh harder than it should have. Where he's like, I can't read anything. It's all in Russian. And the other character is like, I found it. How do you know? It says penicillin on the bottom.
Yeah, this is the one that says it.
I was like, what? Why was this in here?
Yeah, there was, I think right off the bat, there was a funny bit, which was confusing to me because I don't think it was necessarily meant to be super funny, but maybe in kind of like an Independence Day type way. Like there's a bunch of funny parts in that movie, but it's an action movie where they're in Antarctica and there's like a, you know, a split in the shelf or whatever. And they come out because that guy's like drilling, which I wanted to ask you about also. Like, are there scientists in Antarctica drilling? And what are they doing? But anyway, they come out and because there's like a huge cracking noise. And the last thing he says is, I didn't do anything. I think that's the quote, right?
Yeah.
It's like a little kid. He's like, it wasn't me. I didn't do anything. And then he falls into the abyss.
Yeah. Well, that opening scene, it was, I mean, that, yeah, it was pretty bad. So the question, because it really does set the tone for the film, I guess, you know, kind of interesting context and some things about right. So yes, you get scientists do, you know, they do drill for ice. They take ice cores in Antarctica and, you know, really incredible bits of research. So some of the most ambitious scientific projects in Earth sciences have been retrieving these cores that are kilometers long from the deepest parts of the ice sheet. and can tell us what the climate's been like going back almost, well, actually in some places over a million years. So really impressive science. And the important detail is they take those cores from the places where the ice is thickest, and essentially where it's thickest, and where the ice at the bottom is the oldest. And it gives you a really long record to reconstruct the Earth's climate. And they were drilling apparently on an ice shelf, which is a bit of floating ice that's going out to sea. So it's kind of like drilling at the beach. It's not where you're supposed to be, and they'd retrieved nothing of interest there. So, you know, that, yeah, it wasn't the best of starts to the film, but I did appreciate the the visuals of him jumping back and forth dramatically to save the core.
That part was very exciting and hilarious that he made the second jump. That was very surprising.
And he's always got that trusty ice pick to save his ass if he needs it.
And he had an armful of ice core on the second one, so the gap was bigger, and he was laden down, and he couldn't use his arms to propel himself, and yet somehow he made it. That's the science for you.
Yeah, he was thinking like, this time I gotta really jump. This one's important. Okay, so I wanted to talk about how a huge thing in this movie is like global warming has triggered global cooling, and that now there's like an ice age, like a global ice age. So what is the accuracy there? Like, because we always talk about global warming, but I very rarely hear anything about a global cooling.
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. So there is a shred of truth in this, or at least there is some potential. So to start with, if you remember, he stands up in that conference, the scientific conference, and he says, "I found evidence of a dramatic climate shift 10,000 years ago, where the climate cooled really quickly." And what I think he's referring to is a period we call the Younger Dryas, which was we had the last glacial maximum when it was really cold, maximum was around 20 odd thousand years ago. And then the climate warmed up until this present period we're in. So we gave it a relatively stable climate over the last 10,000 years, which we refer to as the Holocene. And just before the Holocene began, there was this episode we call the Younger Dryas, which is a return to colder conditions. And one of the leading ideas for how that was caused, this rapid switch back to cold weather, was a huge glacial lake called Proglacial Lake in North America, called Lake Agassiz.
Named after the tennis player.
Yeah, exactly. that formed in North America, and it drained catastrophically. So an enormous amount of water. There had been melt water from these from the ice sheet that was being stored in front of it, flowed out to the North Atlantic, and essentially cut off this thermohaline circulation, because it made the water fresher and therefore less dense, so it stopped the sinking that you need to power this current. So that was in a warming world, but coming from a very different situation, one where we had these enormous ice sheets sitting on the land mass of the Northern Hemisphere. Going forward, and where I suppose what the film is reproducing, is the concern that contemporary climate warming could trigger cooling through the same mechanism, the shutdown of this thermohaline circulation. So this thermohaline circulation, to give some context, is this big overturning current that in the Atlantic draws water up from the south that's warmer and supplies heat to northern Europe, the northeast coast of the States, and makes the climate much warmer than it would otherwise be. Huh. And the central idea in this film is that the density pump that drives that, when I say a density pump, what's going on is that the water just to the south of Greenland and Iceland is made very dense by cooling from the atmosphere above, and also through the creation of sea ice that makes it saltier. And that causes that water to become dense and sink, and that draws water up from the south. So that's one of the engine rooms of this circulation. And if you freshen that water by, for example, melting ice on the Greenland ice sheet, or causing lots more rainfall over the continents, and that rain running off through rivers into the North Atlantic and by northern oceans, you freshen the water and you can cut off that circulation again. And that's the basic premise behind the film, is that melting ice is freshening the North Atlantic and it cuts off this circulation. And so there is a shred of truth in this. One, we think, or it's thought, that this thermohaline circulation is slowing already. The latest estimate that's tried to do this over kind of long time scales since the pre-industrials, and since we started warming the planet, estimates that it may have slowed by something like 15%. And it's not really known how much it has to slow or how much warming there has to be in order for it to turn off. It looks unlikely for it to turn off this century, according to all kind of plausible warming scenarios, but we can't rule it out completely. So that's out there. And if it were to happen, if it were to cut off, then what you would see, according to modeling studies, is globally a cooling of about 0.6 of a degree. Now, to put that in context, the last glacial maximum, 20,000 years ago, it was about 6 degrees colder worldwide. So we're not talking about a reproduction of those conditions in any case, which the film tries to represent. Locally, in Europe, there could be temperature drops up to around 6 degrees, and it would be a fundamentally different climate. So there are shreds of truth in the film, but essentially the implementation or the following through of those shreds or threads through the film is about as far off as it could be.
Awesome.
But something that I just kind of skimmed across when I did some research for this.
Hey, all right.
That I always kind of wish that these kinds of things get mentioned, but doesn't the Earth, I mean, not constantly because it's over millions of years, but go, like everyone always says, Ice Age, the Ice Age, but there have been 5 Ice Ages, correct? And it's in a constant flux of Ice Age to warm greenhouse climate, Ice Age, warm greenhouse climate. And aren't we, doesn't that technically, not, I know it's a warmer, but aren't we in a Ice Age right now, as long as there is ice on the North and South Pole?
Yeah, that's right. We're in an ice house period of history. Over the course of the Earth's history, it's been on average warmer than it is right now. But over the last sort of 2 and a bit million years, we've existed in a state where we bounce between what we call glacials and interglacials. The glacials are the really cold bits where the ice sheets are bigger than they currently are. So in Europe, there will be ice down to pretty much London in the UK that is centered over Sweden and Norway, that ice sheet called the Fennoscandian ice sheet. And in North America, I'm not quite sure how far south it went, the Laurentide ice sheet, but I think Rhode Island is, I think it's perhaps the terminal moraine, so it marks the end position, essentially, where that ice sheet got to. It's only around that latitude, around the latitude of the Great Lakes. But now we're in, an interglacial, so relatively warm. And we've been in this for 10,000 years, and we would be gradually cooling back to another glacial were it not for the climate warming that we're driving.
So we're knocking it off balance here.
Yeah. But assuming we hadn't knocked it off balance and we were living, you know, a totally carbon neutral life, the Earth would still eventually go either way, right? And would we be fucked then either way?
Yes, that's completely right. It's a really interesting thing to comprehend, I think. It's just the time scale. We'd be talking about, over 10,000 years. But yes, we would be expecting to go back into a glacial period.
Whoa.
And a glacial period may present, far bigger challenges to us.
Isn't it?
The interglacial periods are shorter than the glacial. So we would be heading towards another glacial relatively soon.
So why don't we all just say YOLO and not care about the environment? I mean, if we're gonna freeze over anyway.
Yeah, but we are talking thousands of years. And, you think about how far humanity's come in the last 10,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
The advent of agriculture, settled civilization, etc. We're talking all of that time again and then a bit more. I'm not quite sure how long we would expect the current interglacial to last, but it's in the order of thousands to over 10,000 years rather than measured in the hundreds of years.
Okay.
In terms of anthropogenic climate change, we're talking about fundamental challenges to the way in which our society operates we could say some of those challenges are emerging now, and they would certainly be here vividly by the end of this century. And, when we start talking about tens of thousands of years, there might be other things on the horizon that we want to watch out for before worrying about the climate,
Republicans.
So, exactly. I think it's a really good point for when we talk generally about, our connection with nature and how we view the climate and our systems and how independent we are from climate oscillations, to appreciate that, long term, we should expect some fundamental challenges anyway as we move towards another glacial if we weren't currently warming.
Yeah, that makes sense. Give us the best chance.
I like to believe myself as a happy-go-lucky pessimist, because those are the kinds of things that are always in the back of my mind. And even then, the big end-all of it all is, well, the sun is still going to die one day, and then we're still fucked no matter what.
Yeah, try to be the best human that we can be in the face of inevitable destruction.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. This is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the streaming wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
The break is over. Here we go, back to the show about science.
Okay, so there's a scene, which is kind of cliche, I think, in a lot of movies, where the birds are all, like, migrating away because they know the storm is coming, and then, like, there's all these animals that are freaking out, the wolves escape, there's, like, I can't remember if it's, like, a seal or something, but somebody's, like, howling. And so, I don't know, did that, like, bother you at all, or did that make sense?
Well, it certainly bothered me. Didn't make any sense. That whole episode didn't make any sense at all to me. Every bit about the representation of those storms was so confusing.
Wait a minute. You didn't like the whole three huge storms that look like hurricanes covering the entire Earth?
No, they were just confusing in every possible way. From the structure of the storms to their size, the conditions they were generating, this, you know, subsidence of super cooled air that was killing people. It's just not possible. And none of it was possible. You know, the structure of those storms resembles what happens when essentially you have really warm waters below the atmosphere, which is apparently exactly the reverse of the conditions that were there. So it was like, I don't know, I think it was like, you know, a couple of guys got round in a bar and heard about, you know, that fresh water can cut off the thermohaline circulation, and then like checked on Wikipedia and thought, oh yeah, that's a thing that, you know, that it seems to follow through. And then they just went and did their own thing for the rest of the film and kind of started, you know, doing the equivalent of Trump's Sharpie with extending the track of that tropical cyclone. They just started drawing storms and making up the physics to make it more exciting.
Yeah, that is totally what it seems like.
The flooding and the animals, I presume, were meant to be responding to that. I was so lost at that point that I was taking notes. I was doing my homework, but I can't offer any sensible comments on what the animals were doing because everything else was so confusing.
That's great.
I think what added to that confusion was that it felt like they were reacting so far ahead of the storm. Ooh. Because you see the birds and then they're still like, New York just begins to start flooding in that scene. But you're like in the sky, right. You see like, it looks like thousands of birds leaving.
Yeah.
I know, because it looks like they're essentially reacting to persistent rain, which I guess is not that unusual in New York.
Yeah. The birds are like, guys, this rain is too persistent. This is weird. Let's all leave our homes. This is strange. That was definitely one of the funniest parts of the movie, the rapid rate that it got colder. Like there was a scene in particular, which I thought encompassed it, which is like that they're running through the library and they're like literally being chased by the cold, which is freezing the library as they run.
Yeah. That's the scene I remember from 2005 when I first watched it. Yeah. It's just nonsense because the coldest air that's in the troposphere is warmer than the air that they're apparently running from. And the air that reaches them is meant to be sinking, right? So it's sinking from the top of the atmosphere. And as it would sink, it would warm. And their explanation is it sinks too quickly to warm up. Which is just it's made up essentially. The whole process, is very. There's a lot of artistic license there.
I gotta say, in their defense, they're not scientists, right? And they, I think I read that they tried to involve NASA to help them like consult, and they declined. So, you know, they were writing this kind of like what you said, probably just in a bar with like some shred of, you know, factual evidence and just being like, okay, now what else could happen? That's friggin' crazy. Tornadoes, put it in.
Yeah, that's right.
That tornado scene felt like if you watch The Office, which I know most of the world does because of how popular it is.
Yeah.
There's the episode where Michael makes the movie and there's that shot where he blows Toby's head up and it's like, five shots of the head exploding is like by far the most expensive shot of the movie. That's what the LA scene felt like. It felt like someone that hates the city so much. He's like, I'm going to really fuck them in this movie. I'm going to like really give it to them.
LA was Toby.
Yeah, LA was our Toby.
Yeah, it's true.
It did seem a bit abstract. And also, I now remember some of the other bits that were odd in that sequence. So the hurricane that they said was, you know, the strongest hurricane ever observed was striking just as this was all unfolding, which again, is just, it's backwards, compared to what we expect. It's as the ocean gets warmer, we expect more intense tropical cyclones or hurricanes. And apparently this is going on as the oceans are are getting cooler. So it was like they just, again, as you said, heard these interesting words flying around related to climate change and just merged them all together. But I did get some, there was some hint of them trying to, you know, do some things right. Like that thing with the sinking air, they did say, shouldn't it warm as it gets, you know, as it sinks, as it gets closer to the ground. So I think it should.
Okay.
So I think at least they'd spotted, someone had said something like, oh, that air would warm. And they just decided to have some artistic license over the solution that allowed them to,
yeah,
you know, still have the dead cold.
And I mean, I know it's, you know, super overdone, but I also did appreciate the political aspect of this, where, you know, the people that are actually in charge and making policies just continuously
ignore,
put down the scientist. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I thought that was actually really powerful, that bit. Or rather, one of the most powerful bits of the film, the most serious bits of the film, was that exchange early on in the conference, because that's something that is unfortunately very familiar.
In that conference scene, especially after knowing the Independence Day connection, I was expecting someone to say, hold on, are you saying the climate is changing? I also really loved and appreciated, though confused, that the president was just kind of generic president, but vice president was absolutely Dick Cheney. Like, forget the president, Dick Cheney, we need him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was totally on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I also liked how they deferred to Jack Hall, the scientist, to tell them how to respond to this, you know, international crisis. And he gets up with his marker pen and just draws a line and says, you know, evacuate everyone south of this line. And I thought, shouldn't you have, you know, like a fleet of advisors to actually advise on what to do and not ask this all singing, all dancing, crevasse hopping climate scientist to also evacuate, you know, the entire US for you.
Yeah. And it was funny because everyone above that line, because you're right, it's just completely up to him. They're just trusting him with the advice. And he's just like, well, if you're above this line, which I just drew in half a second, they're doomed. You leave them alone. They got to fight it out.
But it's fine because his son's above that line. So that qualifies him.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. That felt like a Batman, Superman, like, wait, why did you say Martha? I also have a son.
Right. Yeah, the whole thing with Mexico also, like, there was a moment, it got really strange there for a second for me. There was a moment where there was a TV reporter and she was like, the president or the vice president has struck a deal where, you know, Mexico is going to take our refugees in exchange for all of Latin America's debt.
Yeah.
It was like, Latin America is like 20 plus countries. Why does Mexico care? Or how can Mexico speak for, you know,
the
all
rest
Latin,
of
American
Latin America
countries? Yeah, it just seemed like no one edited that line.
I did love that scene. And I do want to, like, I want that to be put out in the world of the, like, I forget what the reporter said, but like in a strange twist of irony, people are now fleeing the border to Mexico. And I was like, oh my God, this feels so good to watch, though.
Yes, it's so true.
I also was confused by the spoiler of the end of the movie when the vice president is giving a speech from Mexico. What power does, like, he's giving it like he is the power of the world, but now right. You are just a man in Mexico. Like, who are you to be giving speeches?
I mean, he's the guy that we're turning to, even though he's Dick Cheney, known asshole, devil himself, Dick Cheney. He has now become the leader. So, you know, I guess the whole world is looking to him for what to do next on the Weather Channel.
And he was wrong.
Yeah, I thought that was actually really funny that he very quickly admitted that he was wrong.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I also thought I liked the connection to the Weather Channel. I thought that was well played.
Well played.
Did you guys also happen to see the parallels between this movie and now? Or was I just like connecting too many dots here on like the first conference and him like yelling at him in the hallways? To me seemed like that's probably what was happening in the White House when Corona was hitting.
Oh yeah.
Like you got to do something. And they're like, fuck off. And then here it is. And now everyone's got to stay inside or move away.
Mm-hmm.
And now the future is changed forever because fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's a decent analogy to draw. It is one that certainly if you like me and a climate nerd and sort of, you know, circulates in those groups, then there lots of parallels have been drawn between just in general the climate change challenge and and what we see right now going on. So, you know, the fact that, I mean, COVID, you know, pandemics, they're known about. And we knew that this was coming to some extent, just a matter of time. And yet it's still an enormous surprise when it comes here. And of course, climate change is different in many ways, but in some ways it's not different at all. We know what the threat is that's out there. And yet we really do dither with respect to what to do about it. So I thought that, yeah, the film in that sense was pretty similar to reality.
Yeah, it seems like similarly with COVID-19, like the climate change scientific community should be leading the way. It's never made any sense to me ever since I was a kid, because we've, like you said, we've known about this for a long time. I mean, you can watch, you know, documentaries from the 60s and 70s where they're talking about climate change. And yet, you know, we've basically done nothing to prevent it. So I don't know. It just seems so absolutely absurd to me that you guys are not the ones making policy decisions. You know, like, it's still not up to the people with any sort of expertise.
Yeah, it's a really, again, another good point, and one that I think is really complicated, actually, because climate science community for a long time have been outlining how serious the challenges we face are, and communicating those as transparently and as strongly as possible. But I think the issue is that scientists aren't necessarily any better qualified than civil servants, politicians, and advising what to actually do next. Because, you know, obviously from a climate science point of view, or rather from the climate system point of view, it's really easy to say, well, we need to reduce our emissions of greenhouse gases yesterday. You know, we need to get to carbon neutral now, just stop emitting. It's simple. But that has to be balanced against the very real pressures and desires of, you know, 7 billion people that are trying to have the best lives for themselves and their children. And we already know from, you know, kind of looking at what may be down, you know, in the pipeline in terms of economic growth, the impact of climate change. To when I say we know what's coming, it's kind of, you know, nothing is known, but this is the best science, the best modeling, groups working together, social scientists, physical scientists. We know that generally it's bad news for things like the global economy, not just, you know, people in perhaps developing countries will be on the front line. So we know that the best thing to do is to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, you know, very vigorously now. But translating that into policy is really difficult.
It seems so simple to me. Maybe I'm a schmuck, but it doesn't seem very complicated at all to me, as far as, yeah, reducing these emissions, you know, the way that factories are run, you know, going green. I mean, I don't know. I mean, limiting air traffic.
I think a great example of how having those policies in place affects real life, even the smallest but great example right now, is just asking people to wear masks, and how many people fighting against that, which is insane. Yeah. It is the most minor inconvenience, but I think to that, like, if there were policy to be like less gases emitted from this factory, that means that factory is putting out less supply, and that means there's less for whatever you want to buy, and people will complain about that. Having a limit on like flights and driving would also cause even more people to complain about that. And it seems like such a fucked position that we've put ourselves in now, that there are people allowed to complain about masks.
That's right. And then I think at the bigger scale, you know, when you look further afield at some of the challenges that are out there, and why I think it is quite complicated, is I think there's something around, well, the numbers around something like 300 million people in India that don't have access to reliable energy, so reliable electricity. And that's, you know, similar case, I don't know the numbers, but a fate shared by, a situation shared by many in sub-Saharan Africa and other parts of less wealthy nations. And the cheap way to electrify countries has historically been, and still is to a certain extent, coal and, you know, polluting forms of energy that put greenhouse gases and carbon in particular into the atmosphere. And the West has, so the Europe, the US, has become exceptionally wealthy through the burning of fossil fuels, you know, through the Industrial Revolution, and is now in a privileged position where we can produce renewable energy at scale quite cheaply, and in many cases cheaper than coal. But it takes incredible investment to get to that point. And for the so-called the developing world that doesn't necessarily have access to at the moment those resources to do it, their cheap way to get electricity and to improve the lives of their citizens now is to use polluting fossil fuels to get their energy. the right thing to do, I say the morally right thing to do in the situation, and there are mechanisms for this in international climate change policy, is for mass transfer of resources from the developed world, the global West, to the developing world, the global South, to help fund that transition. But that's where some of the complexity is, because it requires essentially forward-looking international policy and a will to separate with money and resources to help others develop cleanly, because then it's in the best interest for everyone.
Wow. Well, I personally think people like you should be making these policies. I hope that, I don't know how that can happen. I'll vote for you. Can I vote in Loughborough? How does that work?
Is that a place?
Loughborough
is a place, yes. And I live just down the road of that in,
good start,
in Barrow-upon-Soar, which is an even smaller place, but easier to pronounce.
And probably easier to become mayor of.
I would probably be a hopeless politician. I'm far too disorganized and spend all my time thinking about the weather. So I think I'd probably stick to that and occasionally tell people about the weather and how important I think it is. But I'll leave that to others.
Well, what about, like, you know, what Aristotle was saying? Because I do know that about Aristotle, as you mentioned before, that you are always trying to save the planet in small ways. So are there, you know, you got like your top 10 Tom tips, you know, saving the planet, saving our footprints? I mean, should we be doing compost, you know, not using plastic? What do you think are, like, you can do top three if you want. I'm not going to obviously make you list 10 things, but, you know, what can we do on a small scale besides voting, which, of course, you know, everybody vote progressive policies.
So these are listed, and my memory probably won't capture them accurately, but you can Google this and it'll tell you the top, however many ranked in order for what you can do. I think the top there that I'm pretty confident I'll get right, other than not having a child, is to take one less flight. You know, don't take a transatlantic flight, don't fly, basically. It's a very inefficient way of traveling. I know, unfortunately, I mean, I'm guilty of this, and so are many climate scientists, ironically enough. The lockdown has been great for showing us that we can, you know, share science virtually, but otherwise climate scientists do travel a lot, and something that I think we have to look at.
You sick bastard.
I think we do have to do something.
Do you know, I mean, I know this is your field, but I guess this is something that this is an oversight on me that I've never even looked into. Are there, like, alternative flight fuels or plane designs in the works right now?
I think that there's work being done to try and make the airline industry more carbon efficient. So, you know, you see things like the winglets that were introduced, where the wings curve up at the end. Mm. That was introduced to make flights more carbon efficient, but it's a huge challenge to make them carbon neutral, which is what's necessary in order for us to be able to carry on flying. Because that's the big challenge and the thing to get into all of our heads, is that we want to be carbon neutral. That means not adding another bit of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. So anything that is leading to emissions, and that's just not the flight itself, it's the production of the plane, it's the maintenance of the runways, it's the lights on in the airport.
It's not going
to
happen.
It's everything. We need to figure out a way of doing it without bringing emissions into the atmosphere. So, I mean, of course, this is net neutral, so you can take carbon up elsewhere, but the easiest thing to do is to not put it into the atmosphere in the first place. But I feel sure that I don't know about it, that there's a huge amount of research being done in the airline industry to try and make sure we can have our cake and eat it.
So I just drove from LA to Houston. Would you say, in your words, that I'm a hero?
It depends what you were driving in. What were you driving in?
That's not important. I rented a very large Nissan Pathfinder.
I mean, it's probably better than flying. Depending on, I think pretty much any method that isn't flying is better for your carbon emissions. But there is variability across the spectrum. You know, trains different from buses, cars different from buses, etc. Obviously, an electric car is the best you can do at the moment. Obviously, they're more expensive. It's tricky. You know, I guess one question we need to all ask ourselves is, do we need to be traveling the distances we are? And secondly, the things that we buy, the food miles, etc., can we buy things closer to home? Yeah, that's something that we can do relatively easily, I think. Just a few more minutes looking around the supermarket, you know, that's not going to impact our lifestyle tremendously. The bigger thing that is hard for us, I think, is that we often really want to travel. You know, it's part of the adventure that I think is innate in humans, that we strive for that. We want the adventure and the excitement And it's a really boring solution, isn't it, to say, well, actually, maybe we should just stay closer to home, go for a cycle rather than jump in the car.
Well, it'll protect you from viruses.
And yeah. I'm a hard agree on that because I hate flying. I forgot about that scene mm-hmm. where in the airplane, and I'm sure I already hated flying before that, but for sure this scene did not help.
Yeah, I've always also, I try not to fly if I can help it. I would also, yeah, just echo, you know, to try and get your food from local farms. It's probably much
farmer's market,
healthier.
Baby.
Farmer's market, yeah, support your local communities that way. I during my drive across half of this country, I did get to see some really scary looking farms where there was just like 1,000 cows in what seemed to be enough room for like 7, which, you know, is just going to produce some crap ass burger, which you don't want to eat.
Exactly. Actually, that's one of the things that you can do as well is switch to a vegan diet. That would increase your carbon footprint.
I was just about to ask if I may jump on the pedestal for a second, and you would feel free to correct me. But that same, I was going to say, vegan diet is the way to go. I hate to be so preachy, but it is true. Because of those farms, the majority of the crops that are being grown are being fed to those livestock. So if we started to cut out that livestock, that's more food for the world to have, or less, you know, energy being put out or put into growing crops that are just going to be fed to cows and other animals that are not treated well. And then it's a whole system.
It's a really good point. And that's one of the things, it's a bit complicated to explain, so I won't do the details, but going forward, in order to try and reduce carbon emissions, one of the things that's talked about a lot is capturing our emissions. So growing things to essentially burn, produce energy, and then capture those emissions. So for example, it can be reforestation and then burning the wood and capturing the carbon. And then you actually remove CO2 from the atmosphere. But to do that requires us to change how we use land. And we may have to give up agricultural land that's currently providing food in order to meet those requirements. And these are things that are just kind of out there as kind of crunch points that are ahead, or decisions or things that will have to be considered along the way. But it's really good you mention that now, that, you know, the vegan diet, or at least changing diet and being more efficient in what we eat, isn't just, you know, the reduced carbon that food production has. It's also that it perhaps liberates space to be used for something else to help us bring down our carbon emissions.
Sounds like you got a lot of solutions there, Dr. Matthews. I'm hearing you as a mayor. I'm telling you.
But a confused mayor that misses his appointments, I would imagine.
That's fine. I don't need you to make appointments. I need you to make policy.
You've got my vote.
Okay.
You got two votes all the way from America.
Okay, I'll have to check when the mayoral elections are running. If Barrow even has a mayor, it's a pretty small place.
We can make that. If they don't have it, they need one.
And it increases my chances, right? If it's small, I haven't got my... That's the other way to look at it, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, we are out of time, unfortunately. But Aristotle, I know you're probably producing a bunch of different podcasts, but is there some in particular you want to tell people about or promote?
New Player has joined. It's a podcast about video games. It's really funny. Y'all ever? It's a very silly podcast, so you can tell by the name, with Dave Ross and Hampton Yao.
Sweet.
The Untold Hour, which is a paranormal podcast, which also, it didn't come up, but this movie is based off a book written by one of the hosts of Coast to Coast, which I think and a horror writer, which is why it seems a little bit out there.
Yeah, okay.
I would guess. And then I'm Ari's Tacos on everything.
And what? What was the last one?
I'm like, you can find me on all as Ari's Tacos, Aristacos.
Fantastic. Yes. Follow Aristotle. He is the man. And are these podcasts on Starburns or different companies?
I do some other ones, but those are the first three that came to mind, and those are all Starburns.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, thank you, Aristotle. And Dr. Tom Matthews, any last words like I'm going to kill you? just anything you want to tell people about or promote?
Yeah, so there's a slightly more realistic portrayal of climate change research coming out on June 30th on the Nat Geo channel, about a recent expedition to Mount Everest. This was last year, where we installed, Nat Geo and Rolex were the organizer and sponsor of the expedition. And we installed, we did a whole load of science, including installing the highest weather stations in the world. And also the world's highest ice core was taken by Mario Petocchi of University of Maine. So a nice call, a great segue, and not at all rehearsed, a connection there between the film. That's out June 30th on the Nat Geo channel.
Wow. Okay. Awesome. And Rolex is a carbon neutral company.
They have obviously put their resources into furthering climate change research and better understanding of the planet and the challenges that are ahead. So investing their money in an admirable way in that sense.
Okay, awesome, love that. I was just doing some research while we were talking about the flights, and it looks like Delta has committed like $1 billion to being carbon neutral, but I don't know if that's actually going to happen or whatever. But I don't know. I guess if you're flying, maybe try Delta. I'm not sponsored by Delta. It just came up on Google. Okay. Thank you guys both so much. This was an absolute pleasure. Talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye. Bad Science is hosted and produced by me, Ethan Edinburgh. Our associate producer is Emily Felt. Our engineer is Jeremy Schmidt. Bad Science is edited by Lucas Bollinger, and our social media is managed by Blue Whale Media. Shout out to EJ and Kate. And the executive, please vote for people that are environmentally conscious and are actually passionate about saving the world. Producer is Brett Kushner. Oh, follow us on Instagram at Bad Science Pod. If there's a movie you'd like us to discuss on the podcast, feel free to email at badscience@seeker.com. That's badscience@seeker.com. And please leave us an iTunes review. Give us 5 stars. I sound like an Uber driver, but we really appreciate it. Thanks for listening. Bye.